And that was it. There were things that I was introduced to in that course where I was like, why has this never been told to me before? Why have I never been introduced to this way of thinking or this way of planning my dives?
Off-gassing, a scuba podcast with host Nick Hogle. For some, diving becomes more than a hobby. It becomes a lifelong passion. Jordan Allard first became certified when he was 10 years old, and he has been chasing breaths underwater ever since. I sit down and speak with Jordan about his progression through the sport, which eventually led him to teaching with global underwater explorers. The wide range of diving conditions in the UK, shipwrecks of the UK, advice on dry suits, why he chose to pursue a path with GUE, and some misconceptions one might have about GUE training and their standards. Please enjoy. Jordan, how are you doing this morning?
I am doing very well. Thank you ever so much for having me on, Nick. An absolute pleasure on my behalf. I'm doing good. I'm happy to get chatting.
No. So where exactly are you right now?
So I'm still currently in the UK. This is where I tend to spend most of my winters. It's purely one, a little bit of downtime, but it's also nice catching up with a few of the individuals that I dive with over here in my little home country.
Okay, cool. And it's currently 9 a.m. over there for you, correct?
Yeah, it is.
It's always a little bit weird, not weird, but a little bit weird for the different time zones, just because it's like, you know, I'll be speaking to somebody as they're waking up and starting their day and I'm ready to end my day, or vice versa. And it's just always kind of adds a nice little dynamic to the conversation sometimes. But thank God for technology, right? We can be in this room together.
The marvels of what we have at our fingertips today. I suppose it's always good fun for you trying to work out the timings. I've got my coffee here, so I'm good to rock and roll, mate.
Awesome. So I will jump right in. And the first question that I always like to ask is, tell me about how and why you got into scuba diving. Tell me about that first breath, that first experience, what led to it, what the diving was like. Just tell me all about it, man.
Okay, cool. So my fascination with the underwater world has been around as long as I can really remember. I was never the kid to go home and watch cartoons. I was like Nat Geo, Discovery Channel, Deadly 60, The Crocodile Hunter with Steve Irwin. I was so obsessed with nature. And then when I got exposure to, right, you can now start diving underwater, I was like, this is something that I really have to do. It was like top of my list. So I done a try dive in a pool when I was 9 in Spain. And I think it was that silence, that immersion, that almost blissfulness in like just the weightless state. I was like, okay, I need more of this. And it was always on the forefront of my mind whenever I was away. I was like, I have to go diving. So I went with my family on a holiday to a Mark Warner's location over in Sardinia. And they predominantly do water sports activities. And there was a dive center there that were running tri dives. So straight away, that was it. I was signing up. I was hooked. And then they said, oh, we're actually running a open water class after this. And if anyone's interested in signing up, by all means, come speak to us about it. And we can talk about how the class is laid out. So I looked beady-eyed at my parents. I was like, please, I really, really, really want to do this. And they were a little bit hesitant. They were like, okay, you're 10. It's a lot of classroom work. It's a lot of academic stuff that's going on. Are you sure you're going to want to spend your holiday doing this? And there was no hesitation from me. What's really funny is a few years later, they actually turned around and went, yeah, we never thought you were going to finish the class. We thought you were going to get bored and pull out. So that was it. I was absolutely glued to the hip of the instructor. I was like every morning, first person by the pool, first person in the classroom. And I came away with my open water diver, and every opportunity, it didn't matter where I was either in the south of the UK, I was in Turkey, I was in Spain, I was anywhere where I could go diving. I was just always outside the dive center ready to waddle off with my little 10-liter cylinder, because I was so small at the time, I couldn't carry anything bigger. And that just led me down the path where I was so interested in knowing more and exploring more that I ended up interning as a dive master in the south of the UK straight out of my A-levels, which would be sort of like the end of your high school. So I was umming and ahhing with college and university opportunities. I was looking at like marine biology, zoology and other things. And the dive center said, look, why don't you come and finish your intern here, become an instructor, and you can kind of, you know, take the degree as you move along. Anyway, the degree kind of fell on the back burner on the wayside. And I ended up being in that dive center 7 days a week, purely starting as a volunteer. And then when I saw a little bit of money coming in my back pocket, I was like, okay, cool. I'm really going to dedicate a huge part of my time to this. And I started seeing a career for myself form in front of me. So 18, I was pretty much full time. And as you get more exposure in the industry and you start getting new things introduced to you, it was right, it's time for me to jump into a twin set. So started twin set diving, started taking some of my technical classes. Then it was on to CTR. And by the time I was 21, 22, I was teaching twin set diving and moving to actually becoming a CCR instructor. So it was a little bit pushed and condensed. I do understand and see that now. But I was so headstrong and sort of dedicated to where I wanted to go in my career that it just kept moving. Now I'm 27. I've kind of, what I say, experienced quite a lot in my diving career. I've literally just this past September completed my fundamentals IE, or sorry, my GUE fundamentals and Rec 1 IE. So I'm now teaching under the GUE banner. I also have got a little bit of TDI and SDI instructing under my belt. And predominantly before this, I was teaching all through SSI. So I have purely aimed to make a career for myself in diving, which has not been easy. It's had had a few hurdles placed in its way, but I'm still really striving for it, and I'm hoping to have quite a long and bountiful career in this industry.
Oh no, that's awesome, man! So I just want to bring it back just a little bit. So when you were after you completed your open water and then you said you went into a dive master program, like every chance you got pretty much after that open water course, were you like, okay, what's the next class I could take? What's the next class? And then it eventually led to the dive master. I'm assuming it was the traditional just advanced open water rescue dive master type progression.
Yeah. So that's how I started. I took a lot of specialties as I was moving through, so from the age of like 10 up to 15, and I kind of balanced that out where it was a little bit of just kind of gaining experience and just going and enjoying diving, which for me I think is a huge thing that we always need to be mindful of, is let's not only chase our next certification, but let's also gain real world experience. But it was actually my age that kind of limited how fast I could begin to progress. So I see it as a blessing and a curse. I was young, I was enthusiastic, and that kind of made me just continue diving without chasing cards. But I was also one of those where I was like, okay, what's the next thing? What's my next class? So, okay, I want to do my night diver. I want to do my enriched air night trucks. I want to take my rescue class. I want to look at DPVs. I want to look into dry suit diving. So along the way, there were certain things that said, right, now you're just going to go diving. And then when I either hit an age or I was able to actually progress along the career path, then it was, okay, what's the class that I can take now? So I was kind of, once again, forced into this little career path.
Yeah. No, and I started a little bit later in life, not as early as you. I think I was like 31, 32 at the time. And one of the things that I did have some friends that, you know, as soon as they hit that open water class, they're gung-ho and they're going. And there was a part of me that almost used to be, I look back on it now and I think it was really good how it ended up, because I wasn't always able to go into that next course. If I would have had the money 100%, I would have signed up for that next course right after, you know, I completed a course. But I usually had to wait, just like, okay, let me save up a little bit of money, go into that next course. Oh, I have all these other things that I wanted to do. And, everybody's progression is different. And some people, my first dive was in 2016, And then I became a dive master in 2018 and then an instructor in 2020. So it's a pretty short span of time, but you know, I know plenty of people, I'm sure we all do, who from, you know, that first dive to instructor was like a year or something, you know, the traditional industry recreational route, you know. So, but my path that it took me, it kind of gave me time to go out and do some dives. And I really enjoy, like, looking back on it, it really opened my eyes to different aspects of diving. And then, you know, just this path, well, probably like 2 years ago is when I started to kind of like, oh, okay, let me look at this technical side of things. And oddly enough, I tell people, a lot of people will gravitate towards a backplate and wing because of technical diving. And literally the reason why I did it was because I was really big on traveling. And I'm like, okay, well, what's the most streamlined way to do things? And then, you know, here comes the backplate and wing. And then I'm like, oh, okay, this whole kind of opened my eyes to the technical scene. So I guess leading into my next question, when you started going down that technical path, did you already kind of have a technical foundation, or was it a complete learning curve going from, you know, the traditional recreational, now I'm trying to go into the technical side of things?
Oh yeah, for me there was most definitely a learning curve. So I'd been traditional BCD for upwards of like, how many dives now? Like 120, maybe 150 dives. So then getting introduced to your backplate and wing, it was a new piece of kit that you add to your arsenal. Then you can start seeing the benefits or maybe some of the drawbacks that kind of come with the equipment configuration. So I like the simplicity of it. And I also liked how easy it was to transfer to, you know, your diving. As you say, with traveling, moving with the BC, it can be a little bit more cumbersome. When you have a backplate and wing, or, you know, a few different wings to kind of go with that backplate, it does make traveling a hell of a lot easier, because you say, right, what is the diving that I'm aiming to go do in this location? Right, what is the lift that I need? If you are privileged enough to have a few different backplates, then you can kind of cut down on luggage there. So I really gravitated to it quite heavily. And I like the versatility of it. I mean, you know, you move it from your standard mono single sets diving rig, then you move it to your twin set, then you move it to your CCR. So it's nice being able to have one kind of piece of equipment that then can be translated onto so many different configuration types. So I'm really sold on the backplate wing now. I think it's most definitely becoming more seen and sought after in the industry. And I think that's just kind of moving with, you know, the evolution of the sport. If we look at what we initially started diving with the ALBJs, and we had the J valves. Now we start looking at how far we've come from when we started seeing the sport become more open to the civilian market. I think it's just going through that natural progression, and we're seeing the benefits to it. So I did have a fun time transitioning, but now I'm entirely sold. I would always advocate to definitely try a backplate and wing and see how much it actually helps, improves, and makes your diving a lot more enjoyable. That's my own personal take on it.
Definitely. And the same for me too. So I moved to Malaysia about a year and a half ago. And since I moved here, I actually kind of had to take a step back from teaching, which, you know, in retrospect was a really good thing, because I've been able to further my own education and then kind of formulate a plan on when I finally do get back into teaching. And that was a huge thing for me, is, you know, smaller classes, but I want to teach in a backplate and wing, just because I really do think it's the better piece of equipment, because of the fact that it can progress with you. So say like, oh, okay, I'll have that smaller wing. I can have that travel wing. Oh, okay, now I want to go to doubles. I just need to swap out the wing. I don't need to buy this whole new kit, right? And I am definitely 100% a huge, huge fan of the backplate and wing now. And I completely agree with what you said. So my next question, I guess, would be, when you were transitioning into the doubles, was it something that you just wanted to try, or were you like chasing after? What, like how did you get introduced to it? And then like, what prompted you to want to do it?
Okay, so how I got introduced to it was, I was sort of being mentored by two TITs for SSI, so technical instructor trainers. And I remember it was maybe within the first 3 weeks of me taking my dive master intern that I saw them come balling through the shop. So stages, dry suits, doubles. And I was like, oh, that's seriously awesome looking. And I was like, that is something that I really want to now look at. It was that new next progression level. So I think it's like the level of fascination that comes with the territory. I was told, right, let's get you as an open water instructor, and then we can now start introducing you into this new area of diving. So I had to be patient with it, and I was kind of having to grit and bite my teeth because I'm like, I really want to try something new. So a huge part of it was just natural progression for me. I saw something new and shiny, and I was like, that is the coolest thing I've seen so far. I really want to try it out. And then I think they wanted me to kind of also progress with them. I mean, I think it's good if you want to start seeing the technical market in your dive center grow, you have to expose them to it. And the best way of doing that is also potentially having more and more technical divers or potential instructors that are kind of moving through your dive center. So they were quite encouraging with that as well. So they got me in the pool. We tried it out. They tuitioned me and educated me. And we then finally come around to our lower season, started putting me into classes. We started formulating the training. And that was it. I was then able to start diving the wrecks that I already loved and had explored, but for a much longer time. And then you get introduced into decompression, and that was it. It was right. I'm really sold on this. I'm really, really loving this. And I just wanted to gain more experience and more exposure to it.
Okay. So real quick, the place that you were doing your dive master, where was this again?
So this was in the south of the UK, in Newquay, Cornwall. So we call it like a little bit of a wreck haven. I think, let's see, within 15 miles of the dive center, we were like 3 minutes from the beach. We had upwards of maybe 40 different wrecks, some known and explored, some unexplored, that we could go out and dive. So it was always, we had what we call the bread and butters. So the ones that we dive on a day-to-day basis, and we kind of swap them around. And then we had the ones that were marked but hadn't really been explored and really documented, that when we had a little bit of downtime, we would grab our twins, our stages, and off we go. We'd go and explore them. So that way we had more and more of a playground for us and our divers to go and explore. Some of the wrecks I've dive to no ends, but I'm always happy to literally jump straight back on the boat and get out there. One of the closest ones that we had was like 2 miles from our center, so it was a easy 7-10 minute boat journey out there. So we would dive out of the water. It was it was always engulfed in divers, and it was fantastic. We absolutely loved it. It's a beautiful ship. She's still intact. 2 huge boilers on it. Yeah, it was. I think it was just having that at your fingertips and knowing that you then had the tools in the dive center that allowed you to go and explore it. It was, you know, two things come together and you know it's then achievable.
Yeah. So two questions. The first question is, what are the typical diving conditions like there? And then my second question is, why is there so many wrecks?
Conditions in the UK, they can drastically vary. The best I've had it is 19 degrees, and that's degrees Celsius, and upwards of maybe 18, 19 meters visibility. That is the greatest I've ever seen it there. And the worst I've ever had is 4 degrees, and I can't see my hand in front of my face. So it's really two huge parallels, and you experience each side on the spectrum. But what I really liked is it gave me a chance to experience the absolute best of UK diving, and also some of the harshest conditions you could potentially comfortably dive in. So I think that range of conditions that I was exposed to also prepared me for, you know, diving over in Trut Lagoon or Southeast Asia, where you get these immaculate conditions, but then also going elsewhere where you're kind of slapped in the face with terrible visibility, cold water, and you have to find a way to manage it and also still conduct dives in the safest possible manner.
Okay. Yeah, no, that is pretty amazing, because since you have such a big variety, it does really prep you for a lot of different terrain, I should say, just because So we're, you know, my first dive I ever did was in Thailand, you know, just beautiful blue water, great visibility, and then went back to Texas. And the bulk of my training, bulk of my diving, even to this day, I should say, is in a low visibility freshwater lake. And it is not the greatest place, but there was so many great aspects about it. It was a big, deep lake. And visibility would either be really horrible, or sometimes, you know, on a really good day, you could probably get like 15 meters of visibility. And that was like an extremely good, rare day. But it really taught you how to be comfortable in those conditions. And then when you go into that clear blue water, it's like taking a warm bath. You know, you're like, oh, this is absolutely amazing. And then also too, we, you know, no matter what time of year, and I'm sure it's the same where you're at, no matter what time of year, we'd always hit there'd be a thermocline. So, you know, it would get deeper as the summer progressed, but then as the winter would come along, it would get a little bit shallower. So you always had to be prepared for it. And it wasn't just like, okay, we're going to jump right in there and it's going to be super mellow. It's like, oh, as soon as we hit 10 meters, we're going to hit a thermocline, 20 meters thermocline. So no, it's that I really do believe that that type of diving really preps you and hones your skills to be able to move on and get really, really good. Because I would tell people all the time, like, I'll take a 30 meter day in Lake Travis over somebody, you know, a 30 meter diver in Lake Travis in Austin, Texas, over someone that has just dived blue ocean their whole time. Right? Because they're not going to know what to do when they hit that low visibility in that. It wasn't freezing cold, but it was pretty cold water.
Yeah, it was cold enough to make a big difference. But one, I find this part and parcel of the fun. I mean, you know, week to week, it's always going to change. And it's always that you get there, you evaluate the conditions, you kind of see what is presented to you at the point in time, and you learn how to manage it while still engaging in a sport that you absolutely love. And I think it definitely prepares you for the diversity of conditions that you experience around the world. I mean, not everywhere is going to have the same environment as what you have over in Thailand. So if you're only diving there, you're kind of limited to exposure. So you don't have the chance to kind of go out and once again gain that experience in, you know, different environments and the challenges they present to your diving. So I think it's really helpful for divers to have the diversity in locations that they dive. But I actually find it quite enjoyable as well. So, you know, when you turn up and it's easily gin clear 20 meters visibility, you're like, yeah, we're in for a winner, guys. Like, let's go and absolutely love this dive. And then when you go back to 10 days later and you go, right, the visibility is absolutely shot and we don't know what we're going to see, it's, well, let's still go in because you know it's going to be a laugh and you know it's going to be fun. But you take the good with the bad.
Yeah, no, for sure. So what about the shipwrecks? Why is there so many shipwrecks there?
Okay, so the reason why we have so many shipwrecks there is purely from the First and the Second World War. So we've got one of our creme de la creme, as we like to call it, is a German U-boat called the 1021. That lies 11 meters off the coast at a depth of about 55 meters. We've got other wrecks such as the War Baron, the Peer Gynt, the depth barges that they use to kind of use to detect submarines in the local area. So it's purely the wars that have kind of allowed them to lay at rest. Some, unfortunately, did get taken by severe weather conditions. The Syracuse that I was saying about, that is at 32 meters, and that was moving coal, and it was a German cargo ship that sunk in 1876. If I'm not mistaken. And that unfortunately just went down to really bad swell and heavy storm conditions. So majority of them are purely from the wars, but there are some other little wrecks or other wrecks that are there purely just where they weren't able to manage trekking through the waters when there was a big storm blowing.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. And oddly enough, I mean, I guess it's not odd, but I feel like a lot of divers that I've met from the UK, if they kind of came up in that area diving, they're huge wreck fanatics. You know, they really love the wrecks, and or as they would say, like they want rust. They want to see rust, you know. So no, that's cool. I mean, maybe I've heard it, but I, as of right now, like as we're speaking, I'm like, oh, that's cool, because I don't think I recollect it or have heard that before. So, well, I know that there's obviously, you know, wrecks from the war, but not in that specific area.
Oh yeah, the Battle of Britain, we've got loads on the Dover coastline. So the beautiful thing about being in such a tiny little, well, once fortified island is everything outside of the perimeter. There's always a little bit of rust down for you to go and explore and see. So I think, you know, we kind of always have to look back on our history, and then that kind of gauges what you're potentially going to find around the coastline. You never know what new things are going to be discovered or uncovered, really. We're still trying to go out, plot and chart for new undiscovered or undocumented wrecks. So we do work quite closely with the fishermen, wherever they get their nets tangled or wherever they kind of see a blip on their sonar. If you're having a nice drink at a pub and you kind of run into one of them, you can always have a little conversation. They've probably got a little story to tell of, oh yeah, we think something's here and maybe we can organize you to go dive it and see what we uncover. It's real good fun. But I think that's, you know, that's another beautiful thing that, you know, has kept me in diving, is that sense of exploration and that want to kind of go and see more and more things. We are so heavily, you know, enwrapped and gifted with our rich history. So it's nice being able to go out there and actually see it preserved in a timeless state, to see it as its final moments float in just before it crashed into the bottom. That's one of those things that really, really kind of gets me excited and really makes me want to go, right, let me grab my stuff, let's go. So having it on your doorstep just really made it such a choice place for diving. I think that's what kind of kept me in the UK for such a long time and still keeps me coming back wanting to dive.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. We have, like, there were a few more wrecks off of the east coast of Peninsular Malaysia. And I think there are a few more out there, maybe undiscovered, but, I know pretty recently they've basically been salvaged, because a lot of people will go after the metal. Like these big, just Chinese ships will come in and there was a pretty bad one. It was like probably late last year or earlier this year where, you know, they kind of caught a ship basically just sinking down, not sinking down, but just pulling metal off of the bottom. And then they were going to, you know, somewhere on land and just dumping, and there's like bones popping out and everything. And it's quite sad because it is this big part of history. And then they'll just come in and basically just salvage it for the metal, which I had a conversation with someone. They were telling me why they were salvaging it for the metal. But it's just, it's a sad thing. There's still a couple out there, but I know, I feel like they're probably, or I know there used to be more, and they're kind of getting just not even lost to the Mother Nature or anything. It's just people coming in and basically like ripping those things up out of the ground.
Yeah, it's always a sad one. One, it takes another thing for us to go and explore out the water. So it is detrimental to what we want to go and do. But when you're disturbing history and when you're disturbing something that actually has a huge story behind it, you're kind of masking it. You're covering it up. I can understand wanting to salvage it for, you know, repurposing, but I think leaving it where it lies and really immersing yourself in what you're seeing, I think gives it much greater value and much greater purpose. We can kind of reflect back on it and say, wow, this was a time where the world was so set on tearing itself apart. Let's kind of look at it. Let's learn from it. Let's, you know, continue to, you know, see what it's trying to educate us or teach us. I know it does happen. I don't believe it really happens too much in the UK. I think it's quite heavily protected by MAO regulations and other things that I'm not hugely educated on. It's just always sad when you're hearing that this is kind of taking place. But unfortunately, some people only see it as like a rusty bit of money sat at the bottom of the ocean. They know that they can do something with it. Others look at it and say, wow, that is a piece of history that should be left being untouched. Especially when you think of some of them are literally the final resting places for some unfortunate souls. So I would always gravitate away from taking anything from there, especially if you're trying to take the entire wreck itself. I'm like, no, leave that be, please.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I just have a question for you for my own personal inquiry. So doing a lot of the type of diving that you're doing, I'm assuming that you've probably are pretty familiar with dry suits, or you probably got into a dry suit pretty early on. Because right now I'm currently in the market for a new dry suit. What dry suit do you dive?
So currently I'm diving a trilaminate Rothos 450. This is a relatively small Italian brand that I stumbled across. I've played around with a few different dry suits. I've had Santis, Otters, Fourth Elements, and for me, they're a work uniform. I'm only going to get so many years of diving out of them before they really start showing a lot of wear and tear. I'm a big fan on the Trilams. I like the fact that they don't have any degree of compression when you're looking at neoprene suits at depth. I was maybe 40 dives in before I then transitioned over into dry suit diving. So I'd like to say I do have quite a lot of experience with them. I've also educated and got myself involved into fixing and repairing them. So socks, seals, I can dabble in zips. I'm not like overly fond of toying with zips, but I've begun to kind of really understand their construction, how they're built, and you know, some of the areas that they're always going to struggle with. You're always going to get stress points on the suit. There's always going to be small holes that you puncture. But I love dry suit diving. I like the redundancy it gives me. I like the comfort that I experience from them. I like the fact that when I'm doing, you know, long exposure dives, they really kind of insulate and protect me from the environment. I would always advocate, if the environment dictates or if your diving dictates, that you should preferably have one, I'd definitely give it a go. I love my dry suit to absolute bits.
I do know Rothos. There's a Fathom Rebreathers, they sell them on their website. And I believe one of my friends ended up getting one of them. And I kind of forgot about them. And then someone reminded me of them a few days ago when I was kind of putting the word out, like, hey, what are your thoughts on dry suits? And then so my game plan was, I'm like, okay, I'm going to email 10 different dry suit companies. Because obviously dry suits, it's not a small expense, right? It's kind of a big expense. And it's like, okay, I'm going to email 10 different companies and I'm just going to see which companies I get the best customer service from, just in case something happens with the dry suit and I need to return it. I want to know that I can talk to somebody and it's not just like I'm just sending emails out into the darkness. I ended up connecting with one company. They literally emailed me right back. I've heard phenomenal. I don't think I've found one bad review. I've been looking, and the fact that they emailed me really quick, the customer service. So I think I might go with them. Have you heard of SF Tech?
I have heard of SF Tech. I too have only heard amazing things from them. I understand the suits to be near enough bulletproof. So if you are able to get your hands on one of those, I think you're going to have many, many dry dives and really enjoy your time diving that suit. I've seen a lot of people rock up in them and they look, excuse my French, but they look the absolute nuts. They look really, really hard wear and they look super, super comfortable. And I know that they are designed with, you know, very heavy duty demanding divers in mind. So I don't think you can go wrong with an SF Tech.
Yeah. See, now there's another one to add to my book of good reviews. Cause I literally was just like, okay, you know, there's the Santis, the SF Techs, the DUI, Avatar, just all these different Ursuit, Otter, all these different companies. And I'm like, man, this is a really tough decision. And, you know, I literally emailed all these companies to see which one would have the best reception. And yeah, SF Tech, I mean, literally got back to me. I've been just actively speaking to them, which is always nice from a consumer standpoint, because, you know, it's just nice to know that, like, hey, if something breaks and I need to send it in for whatever reason, maintenance, you know, get something refurbished on it, it's not like, you know, you'll never hear from the company again. And it's just like, oh, okay, there's, you know, a few thousand dollars just down the drain.
Yeah, like you say, it's a huge investment. So whenever you're actually in the market for buying a new suit, you know, you're going to really want to go for the best possible choice for you. I think we've hit almost like a plateau where there's so many amazing and incredibly designed suits out there that you're unlikely to go wrong. But I think customer service really kind of stands alone in some manufacturers. It's very easy to become brand loyal and, you know, have your dedicated, I like this because of whatever reasons they may be. But I really think that it's hard to choose a bad dry suit now. I think so many of them are well constructed and really built for what we want them to be utilized for. So I think if you went for any other suit, you'd also be just as happy. But I can totally respect people saying, I went for this reason. So I think we're kind of at that point where it's like choosing between an Audi, a Mercedes, a BMW. It's like, okay, they've all got their features and their functions. They've all got their like cool little quirks. But are you really going to be disappointed with whatever car you jump into? No. I think that's where we're kind of at with a lot of drive suit manufacturers today.
Okay, cool, cool. No, that's good to hear, because there are very many choices out there. So my next question I wanted to ask you is GUE. How did you gravitate towards them? I mean, it seems like a pretty simple answer as we're talking, but so you are a GUE instructor. How did you decide? Why did you decide to go down that path?
Okay, so I have to take a little bit of time to think how I'm going to tell this story.
Take as much time as you need.
So I was introduced to GUE when I was cave diving in Mexico. And I was with two friends, colleagues, and one of them was a GUE fundamentals instructor. So we're off diving, we're having a great time. And at the end of every dive, he's always given me an element of feedback. You could have done this better, you could have proved in here, you could have maybe made this easier for yourself. And I'm there going, okay, so I've got this individual telling me this, and then the other individual kind of just give me high fives, pats on the back saying, yeah, you're absolutely bossing it, mate. You're doing really well. Absolute awesome dive. And I'm thinking, okay, so why is this guy always giving me feedback and this guy is just kind of singing my prayers? So I started having a bit of a sit down chat with him, as you do at the end of most dives. And he then started giving me more well-orchestrated answers into why he was giving me feedback and why he was always assisting me in improving my dive. And as we're continuing our trip through Mexico. And that then really kind of made me go, right, this person here, it's not only he wants to go diving, but he also wants to see everyone reach their potential. So it then made me go down this route of, maybe I should like dive into GUE a little bit more. Maybe I should actually see what the organization is about. So I ended up working for a dive center over in Greece, shout out Scuba Life. And he is a GUE instructor himself. So he said, look, let's do your fundies. We'll get a class together. And that was it. There were things that I was introduced to in that course where I was like, why has this never been told to me before? Why have I never been introduced to this way of thinking or this way of planning my dives or even just this fine tuning and meticulous assessment of my ability in the water? And that was it. A new door opened and I was straight for it. I was like, okay, this is some cool stuff. They're like, you know, really, really set on bringing everyone up to a really fine level of diving. So I took my fundies and then it was my tech one. And then it was my CCR one. And I was so obsessed with their way of teaching and their way of kind of conducting dives that I said, this is something that's really, really opening my eyes. And then it allowed me to actually start working in some project style diving that they were conducting. So I got exposed to the agency more. I started speaking with more and more instructors and more dive. And I saw them all coming in with this, you know, beautiful, happy demeanor and, you know, bright side of mentality, but always in the water, they worked in such great unison. They were so well planned and thorough with whatever task was happening. I was like, these guys just, it's almost like they're sharing a brain. I don't know what's going on here, but I would really like to be a part of this. So I reached out to a couple of previous instructors that I had taken classes with, and they directed me to Dorota, who I emailed and said, look, I'm really interested in actually being a GUE instructor. I'd like to improve in my all-round teaching ability. I'd like to educate myself further in the industry and the agency. And I really think that this is a style of diving that aligns with what I want to do and what I believe in. So I was invited onto the ITC, and for the first 4 days, me and all the candidates looked at each other up and down the table and went, do we actually know what we're doing? Because it's really interesting how they do things. It's, you know, where there are good points, they kind of cover it very briefly. And then they really aid and assist you in saying, look, these are maybe the points or the areas where we can improve in the best way or in the most. So let's really hone in on this. So it was like you're always receiving this constructive feedback and trying to elevate you in the areas where you're maybe not performing as greatly. And coming to the end of it, there was like a nice one-to-one personal debrief and overview of how the course went. They then told me where I kind of need to maybe bring myself up a little bit more. And I liked it. It was let's cut the crap. Let's tell you exactly where you are and where you need to kind of improve. So I worked at it, and I like having goals that I set myself to achieve. And I like knowing that even myself with the so many years of experience I have, or the exposure that I've had, I'm still learning. I've still got something new to kind of, you know, add to my list of growing achievements. So I then organized, after getting all my signatures with an IE, I then took my IE, and apparently I was good enough and conducted the class well enough where they were like, yeah, okay, you've got this, man, get teaching. So they sent me off on my merry way with a pat on the back. They told me, keep working at it, keep striving for your goals, and welcome to GUE. And I love it. I absolutely love this agency. I love what it stands for. I will always sit there and say there's something for everyone out there. And I just so happen to have found this. I will never sit there and say it's the be all and end all and it's the greatest. It's just something that I really, really like. And I can say it aligns with my diving.
Okay. No, I like that, because some of those points I absolutely agree with. Because so I am very recent. Obviously, I've known of the agency for quite a while, but I'm very recent fundamentals student as of like 2 months ago. And definitely just those eye opening moments where I was literally just dumbfounded, like, why am I just learning this now? You know, I know that I still have ways to go, but I'm just like, why am I just learning this now? You know, it was quite funny.
It's those little tips and tricks, or those little as we call like GUE estimates, where you're like, wow, that really makes my diving so easy, and I've been doing it in the most like silliest and confusing way possible for so many years. Like, and it's almost like you just hold your head in your hands, you go, why has this never been shown to me before? It's so useful in my diving. And it made me laugh to no end. I'm like, oh, wow, I've been teaching, and I've been, you know, thinking that I was doing it in a very, very productive way. And now this is kind of like turned up at my desk, and it was like, yeah, you could have been doing it a lot easier for a lot longer. You're like, oh, great. Cheers. Cool. Okay. I'll start using this tool.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so the final part of the IE, you actually, if I'm correct, you have to teach a class on your own, but under direct supervision of an IT. Is that their term? Is that correct?
Okay. So what you've got, an instructor trainer and a instructor evaluator. So you've got your IT and your IE. Now the GUE process to becoming a instructor is you basically oversee a class being taught, and they prefer it being done by an IE or an IT. And then you enroll in your ITC, and there's now a two-step signature verification process. So you've got one set of signatures. If I counted them, I think they're for everything, maybe upwards of 60 different signatures. So you have to have scored at least a pass or above in all categories on your first signature side. And then once you've got all of those complete, then you can try and organize a class, get an instructor evaluator in, and then they watch you run the class from start to finish. And they then mark you on, again, all of the signatures that you have already got to say, congratulations, you know this well enough where we can trust you to go off and continue teaching without direct supervision. So rather than like a traditional IDC or ITC through for other agencies, where it's like a 10-day lead up and then like a 2-day evaluation, what they say is, you need to get all these signatures, and then you need to get them all again. So you, yeah. So it's like, okay, cool. And I really enjoyed the process. I mean, was it easy? No, but coming off the back end of it, it was so fulfilling and something that really made me go, wow, I'm on a new path. I'm yet to discover new things and be exposed to another wonderful world of diving. So I had a great time doing it. It was definitely a roller coaster, but I've now made some really, really great friends through kind of doing that, as we all do in diving. I've got some really cool colleagues that I get to network with. You know some of them. I think you've even had them on the podcast. I've really found that GUE is this sort of like tight-knit family, and that, again, I really, really love about the agency. It's we've just had our conference over in High Springs, Florida, and that was just one great experience to kind of be a part of. I thoroughly enjoyed every moment of that. That was a huge amount of fun.
Cool. So when you're teaching the class, I'm assuming they're starting you out, I don't want to say lower level courses, but is it just like you're going to teach a fundamentals course, or, you know, because I would assume they're not just throwing you into a tech one or a tech two or a cave one, or are they? I don't know.
Oh, no. So if you're going to get in teaching, you have to be the level above what you want to teach. So if you want to start teaching fundies, you have to be a tech one. If you want to be a tech one, you have to have your tech two or your tech two plus. So they always want you to be one level above of whatever you want to teach. So I had what we call modules, which other agencies would call chapters. It's basically modular 1 through 6. I would have already given the presentations multiple times over, so I would hope to have known them pretty well off by heart. And they say, right, we'll sit down. This is kind of what we are looking for. You're going to take full control of the class. You're going to be looked at on time management, safety in the water, control, you know, how you deliver the presentations, how you improve the student's ability. And they look at encompassing everything that they want from an instructor, and you're evaluated all the way through. So if you ever have the instructor that steps in, it's not an immediate fail. It's just, okay, there may have been something here that you missed that I felt was crucially important, or there may be a moment where I need to kind of aid the class in, you know, picking up with time. So the IE does work with you. They don't just kind of sit in the corner, you know, with a death stare and a little tick jar, you know, really throwing you off track. They are really, really helpful throughout the process. But they're also not afraid, if they really think that the class isn't developing or moving as it needs, to get involved and say, look, I'm going to take over from here. Unfortunately, you haven't passed this time around, but we now know the areas that we need to look at, and we can work together to, you know, improve for the next class. And then you kind of organize the second class, and away you go with it. So as much as they kind of do hang over your shoulder and kind of throw you off a little bit, I suppose, maybe that's a bad word to put it, but they kind of are there, and it is a little bit nerve wracking. They're also really supportive in helping you develop and become the best diving educator that you are striving to be. So I really enjoyed the process. I think it was a different experience, but I could really see the value in why they do what they do.
No, that's awesome. And yeah, because I really, really enjoyed my course to the point where, you know, I opened up communication with my instructor just to kind of, because I was curious to like, oh, what's the process of becoming an instructor for something like this? And then also just it kind of piqued my interest in wanting to further my education within the agency, and just kind of see like, okay, what's this next course? And the biggest reason, I mean, there's a lot of different reasons why I've wanted to take a fundamentals course for quite a while. I think as a diver, you hear about fundamentals, it's kind of like, you know, can I cut the mustard going in? Can I pass this holy grail of classes, right? And then also another big reason why we ended up taking it, I took it with my girlfriend, who just became a diver earlier this year. And, you know, me kind of further along the path, I've known of GUE. And I was like, hey, we should go take this fundamentals course together, because you and me are going to be diving a lot. You're newer. I feel that you will pick up a lot of good skills and learn a lot of good things. But the biggest thing is, me and you are diving together, it'll create a better team situation, to where, you know, I'm comfortable with you in the water, you're comfortable with me in the water, we're both comfortable in case something happens, you know. So that was a huge reason. And so my girlfriend went into the course, I think, with like 25, 30 dives, and she thoroughly enjoyed it. And the course was like literally, even for both of us, I would say like just night and day from when we went in there. I literally felt like, I'm like, man, I have a pretty good skill set. But even walking out of that course, I was like, I can see and feel the improvement. You know, even with her, she was saying the same thing. So
I think we always need to look back and say, right, where did GUE originate from? And it was all project-based diving. So they wanted, you know, unison in the team. They didn't want any hiccups or any confusion. They wanted it to run so well so they could have successful projects. So introducing that into the diving mentality is a bit difficult when you've got, you know, small discrepancies in how skills are performed, or, you know, how some things are just a tick box exercise. It's okay, can you clear a mask? Yeah. Well, how comfortably can you clear the mask? Are you doing the step-by-step procedures to kind of get in there in the most efficient way possible? So the entire idea about the fundamentals program is to really look at your all-round diving ability and almost fine-tune it. It's not to say you can't dive. It's we know that we could improve here. The best thing that I got told is it's like diving with your best friend, and you want your friend to be the best diver possible. So what are you going to do? Are you going to give them a high five and a pat on the back at every skill they do, because some are going to be better than others and some are going to need a little bit of work? So if it's your friend and you really want them to have a successful, you know, dive or even career in diving, you're going to say, oh, this was pretty good, but this is where we can improve it. And that's what I found, and that's what I really liked. It was, there's always areas that we can improve, and there's always ways that we can, you know, become better in diving. So let's really try and bring everyone up and reach the, you know, reach our potential, because it then aids us in safety in diving, it keeps control in diving, it allows us to explore and, you know, conserve and protect the underwater environment in a better way, because we are so free and open with our mind space, and we're not overly consumed with what are we needing to do now. If you've got immaculate buoyancy and it's absolutely untouchable, you know that you can really control and reposition and adjust yourself in the water without having to really think about what am I needing to do to achieve this. It then allows you to take in whatever's in front of you. You want to take this cool picture? Right. Well, your buoyancy is on point. You can position yourself to get the best angle. Okay. Now you've got the shot that you've really been itching for. If you want to look at, you know, even surveying, documenting, or just diving wrecks, having certain things in your arsenal and having the ability to really control yourself in the water just aids you to have a more constructive and successful dive without stirring up the sediment or the visibility, damaging you or your nice shiny equipment, preserving the wrecks for future divers to come and take a look at. So there's so many things about why that class is there that really help us in our diving. Yeah, the fundamentals is a fantastic class, but I really think we need to be mindful of, it's not there just to kind of say, this is how we should dive. It's there to say, we know that we can be better.
Definitely. It really was an eye-opening class. And a big thing that I had going into the class is I actually had a lot of misconceptions going into the course. And this is actually one of the things that I wanted to kind of reach out to some instructors and people within the agency and ask is, as an instructor, as someone that's kind of been around the GUE scene for a little bit, what are misconceptions, big misconceptions that you see that people have coming into a course, or maybe they don't want to take the course or they're hesitant because they might have this idea? Because I definitely had a few, and a lot of them, if not all of them, were completely just blown out of the water. Like, holy cow, why did I ever think this in the first place? So what are some misconceptions that you will come across when people approach you, or about just one misconceptions that you will come across?
Okay, so one of the biggest ones we have is GUE is only technical. So GUE isn't only technical. What we say is we use the tool for the job. So if the tool for the job is a single cylinder, take a single cylinder. There's no reason to overload yourself with all this cumbersome equipment just to go and survey eelgrass at 6 meters, which I've been a part of and I've done with a few different divers. If the dive dictates something else, then we now have to start looking at that. So GUE isn't just a technical organization. It stemmed from cave diving, which is where it has that misconception, but it allows us to experience and explore every area of the environment in a very, very conductive way. The second is, I have to be mindful of how I kind of say this, but I suppose, you know, we are the best. We are definitely not the best, okay? And I am not here to kind of try and sing our songs and praises. What we really can say about GUE is our standardized approach to diving really helps us conduct successful projects. So we will not say we are the best at doing something, but what we have is we've developed a system that really works well in the underwater environment. Everyone's got a different way of doing things. That's totally fine. We have an answer for why we do things, but we'll never say, oh, it's because this is the best way. We just say, because if everyone does it this way, then there's nothing that can trip us up. So it could be something as simple as, you know, even long hose deployment. We do it by such a segmented step-by-step approach that it really helps keep control and allows the skill to happen in such a way that there's nowhere we can really trip ourselves up. So if everyone is basically uniform and does it the same way, then it means in a real world emergency, when it's unfolding and it's stressful and it can be chaotic and things are likely to spiral uncontrollably to no end, we are doing it in such a way that it helps reduce the further complications that can come with it in a stressful environment. So that's another big misconception. We just have a way of doing things, okay? We are not saying it's the best. I think another one is with our gases. So yeah, we have a reason why we use our gases. There are arguments to why some gases are more preferable, but we kind of look at the success through evidence. So if we've had 200,000 successful dives using specific gases and someone says, oh, well, this one's better, well, we like to have evidence provided to us and we like to have a large amount of evidence before we start saying, okay, maybe there's other things that we could change or there's areas that we can look into. So we then start taking that into consideration and it gets brought to the board and then they have a big discussion about it and say, right, should we change things? Should we maybe, you know, look at reworking or tweaking things to make our diving more successful? But we look at the success of what we've been able to achieve doing it, you know, through the GUE system and that holistic approach. And we are always open to change when it comes through and it really shows itself. But there's nothing at the point in time where we like jump onto the bandwagon, I suppose, where we say, right, this is a new thing that's coming through the door, so we need to adapt it now. It's like, okay, well, let's give it some time. Let us, you know, actually see how it performs in the water. And now we can start looking at it once it's got a little bit of, you know, longevity behind it, once it shows its success rate. I think they're pretty much the biggest ones. So yeah, we have a way of doing things. It works for us and we completely understand that not everyone's going to, you know, have the same wish to do it our way. And that's completely fair. Like, you know, diving is a sport open to the masses and everyone's going to find what they want out of it in their own way. If GUE is your way, wonderful. Welcome aboard. Come dive with us. If you're not really, you know, feeling the agency or you're not really keen on putting down your BC just yet, that's absolutely fine. We've got no problem with that whatsoever. You're still more than welcome to dive with us.
No, I definitely am very interested. Like I said, I took that fundamentals course and it really piqued my interest to be like, what's next? Well, yeah, man, let me throw out, I guess, my final question of the evening, let you go and enjoy your day. So being from the area that you are from and the diving that you've gotten into, and, you know, we kind of touched a little bit on it, the dry suits, what advice would you have for a diver who is about to get into cold water diving, kind of like the territory of diving that you came up in, the territory of diving that you're in? What advice would you have for that diver getting into that cold water, maybe low visibility environment?
Okay, one is brace yourself because that cold water does hit you differently. I would say take your time. Don't, you know, go running into it straight away. You know, build up your capacity, take your time adapting and, you know, kind of converting over into it. Be very open-minded, because there's some incredible things that are, you know, lurking beneath the icy cold waters, wherever you may be. It opens up your dive in to all-round season hobby. So if you are looking at not really ever putting down your mask and your fins, then having the ability to kind of dive in so many different conditions, or especially in different temperatures of water, then it means that you can experience what you love all year round, which is a thing that I really, really love. Don't go for the latest and greatest and the absolute amazing thermo suits that are straight on the market. Ease your way into it. So get some really, really good undersuits, get something that's really going to thermally insulate you from the environment. Really, if you get the chance to go explore and try before you buy different suits to see what you really like. If you come across a dive center that actually has them for rental, I'd definitely give that a go. And yeah, just take your time kind of building into it. It's very easy to get ahead of ourselves and kind of go, you know, screaming into it and saying, right, this is me now. I've identified as a cold water diver and I'm going to be like this all the way through. Be mindful and really take your time adjusting to the changes, because that's going to be the key thing. It's different problems are going to present themselves at different points in time. And if we go in too headstrong, then we can find that they trip us up a lot more viciously than what we were hopefully expecting. So yeah, go in with it with a very open mind, keep diving and really go and explore some of the cool icy stuff that is actually out there waiting for you.
Words of wisdom right there. Jordan, thank you very, very much for coming on to the podcast today. I really, really appreciate it. This has been absolutely amazing, insightful, and just once again, thank you very much.
No problem. My absolute pleasure, Nick. Yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation and I look forward to hearing it.
Off-gassing, a scuba podcast.